I guess we can get started. Welcome everyone to the Des Plaines Public Library, and this is our third annual NaNoWriMo Showcase. 7 years ago, we hosted our first NaNoWriMo here at the library, and a lot of the people who attended, they didn't want it to end when it was over, and they asked the person who started it to if it would be possible for them to keep coming. And out of that grew our writers group, and our writers group has been meeting on Tuesday nights ever since. So we're really happy that out of that has grown this showcase. We get new members, and it's great. So now I'd like to introduce Ann Anderson. She's one of the members of the writers group.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming. I'm going to make this kind of short because the whole point is to read. And thank you very much to Christine and Dave and everybody at
Tony.
Yes, everybody who's recording this and helping us and supporting us. And it really feels very good to be a writing group as a part of Des Plaines Library.
Who is the first person?
It's
all right.
First person is Dina.
Hi, I'm Dina Nardo. I'm not in the writing group, but I'd like to be if I didn't know where it was. I have my own grading group that I participate in. So the first thing I'm going to write, it's just, I do a lot of flash nonfiction. It's called The Plains. Rolling east on Interstate 80 through Nebraska, a brown Toyota Corolla blending with the browns and greens of the barren plains. The undulating fields of green, brown and gold, dotted here and there with a clump of hardy trees, able to withstand the drought, heat, and cold winds that roar across these featureless plains at 70 miles an hour. The only sign of life has been herds of black Angus cows and black crows. We leave behind the majesty of the Rocky Mountains, each mile east making them shrink on the horizon until all that's left is emptiness and a ribbon of concrete east. What type of hardy soul would find peace in this landscape? Days, months, and years must run together like the way that the land seems to blend with the sky. The pioneers rolled across these grasses, mile upon mile, in wooden, animal, and human trains, leaving the East and civilization as they knew it for a promise of land, gold, religious freedom in the West. Standing at the base of Scott's Bluff, we can see the wheel ruts of those long-ago wagon trains. The sight of these bluffs brought joy to the travelers who had spent months crossing the windswept plains. Before them loomed the treacherous Rockies, and beyond that, their promised land. We roll east, the sameness lulling you into a trance of monotony. Our promised land lies to the east, among the towering skyscrapers of Chicago, a man-made mountain range of steel and glass. Do I have time for one more? Mm-hmm. This one is called Lottery Winner. I fantasize about holding the winning lottery ticket, immediately planning out how I would spend, save, and give the money to my family, friends, and charities, nicely spreading it about while keeping enough to keep me comfortable and traveling until I could no longer walk. Reality is, I rarely buy an actual ticket, but somebody has to win, and on that rare day I pick one up. It might be me. I think the first thing I would do is book two trips, one to Antarctica in February, the optimal time to go there, when ice packs slightly recede from the continent, just enough to bring an icebreaker close enough to reach the landmass by zodiac. There I would walk among the hordes of penguins. I'd look for males carrying their eggs on the tops of their feet as they waddled about walking eerily close to my own walk in winter. Kinsmanship. From this trip, I would fly to my final continent, Australia. I'd take a walk about and view kangaroos in the wild, hopefully not meeting up with any of the world's deadliest snakes that seem to concentrate on that island continent. I'd cuddle koalas and look for Tasmanian devils and make a pilgrimage to what used to be called Ayers Rock and watch it turn brilliant red at the sunset. At that moment, I'll have fulfilled my life's goal of having visited all seven continents. Thank you.
Next is Nicole.
Hi, everybody. I was in a writer's group in California, and now I recently just joined a writer's group in Park Ridge. So our teacher, Kelly, said she got the invitation. So thank you for inviting us. I think I might be the only one from my group here. I'm going to read two short poems. My first one is a self-reflective poem. And then my other one is short children's poetic, and I get a lot of my writings, and I'm kind of influenced. I have three boys, so I get a lot of my writing pieces from them. So my first one is self-reflective poetry. It's Strings on a Violin. My life is like strings on a violin, each one playing a different song, a different string, a different day. Some highs, some lows, some off keys. But at the end of the day, it's my life, my songs, and I can choose to play them again or learn from them. You can change the instrument, but it will still be the same. Your days now to see how you will play. Thanks. And then my next one is Ladybug. So that's a short children's poetic story. Red and black, black and red. Round is a circle. Do you know who I am? I am a ladybug, red and black. The dots on my back tell you how old I am. The little bug looks so sad. Counting each dot, he gets sadder. Why so sad, my little bug? You're getting more spots. I always want you. I feel so sad and blue. Well, I am here now, and that is what matters. Come here, my little bug. Sit on my knee. I will tell you how it's going to be. We treasure our days together. Seems we always learn something new. Days and years to remember. Memories we will always share. Me with you, you with me. We're always together. Our love and our stories to get us through. Now look at your wings. Now look at mine. They are shaped in mommy's heart, yours to treasure. We will never be apart. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Julie Evanson, and I'm going to read a short poem, a memoir poem, and then a short story. My mom said it was true. I was born with a smile on my face. I didn't know I was a welfare baby until the age where it didn't matter, until the age where I understood my mom's superhuman strength. At the age of one, we no longer received public aid. At the age of three, we lived in a four-bedroom house with a large backyard, carpeted with green grass and rainbows that appeared with sprinklers, large enough that as I grew, I could hit a tennis ball over the fence into the alley where other forgotten soccer balls were. Piano lessons for three children who were prodded to play. At 10 years old, Annie met Chicago's Broadway. Classmates bragged of seeing it live. I never told my parents I wanted to go. My mother worked, my father cared for us at home. But one day I received a treasured gift from my dad, an album, my very own Annie. The record player played it throughout the house. I sang to It's a Hard Knock Life for Us while dancing on brown marble carpeting, the best gift I received, to dance and sing to the album over and over. Mom took my sister and me to the hairdresser one day after her work. What would you like? The hairdresser asked. Annie with a little Shirley Temple. The kids laughed at my new hairdo. There's a picture of me with the hair. I looked both pleased and embarrassed. I never got a perm again. I looked nothing like Annie or Shirley Temple. They were blue-eyed, I was brown. They had red and blonde hair, I had brown. They were white and had freckles. I was olive with moles on my face, one on my upper left cheek, one on my nose, one above my lip. They could sing and dance, I couldn't. I used to daydream while washing dishes. What if I were orphaned like Annie? What if Mom and Dad never met? Would I have been born? Would I have been me? No, I concluded, I would be someone else completely. I'd be like an apple that fell out of a tree, no longer belonging to that branch. I daydreamed a lot when I was little. I daydreamed when I was older. I daydreamed that I could sing and dance or fight like Bruce Lee. Here's a short piece. Come gather round. Delicate green leaves and tendrils motioned the seedlings closer to her. The leaves of the young plants rustled as they glided towards their guide. Soriana extended her branches and her leaves felt the warmth of the sun's rays nourish her. The earth, as you all know, is very, very old. There is evidence of giant and small creatures that walked this earth. Today we look at one lone creature that was far from the remains of others. She shuffled in a circle around a solid black mass that was rounded at the top and tapered back. It faced the ocean, Take a close look. The seedlings gathered as Soriana continued. This one looks as though the weight of a choice were so great that the balance of life rested on his shoulders. Around here, we call him the thinker.
Maggie? This is an excerpt from last year's NaNoWriMo novel. It's still a work in progress. I wrote it in the memoir style. It's called Borrowed Time. The week of the surgery, I wanted to spend as much time with my dad as I possibly could. I was so nervous that these were our final days that I would just sit in the room with him, while he slept even, just spending sweet time, trying to make it all meaningful and poignant. I wanted to hold his hand and say and hear loving things that would resound in my mind and heart for the rest of my life. Thoughts that choked me up and made me miss the man already while he was still alive right in front of me. I craved that emotional satisfaction of making every second count, and it stressed me out. The day before the surgery, I felt a sickening sense of urgency at this project of making memories. But I walked into the usual debate about the dinner tray. Did I hear you say you ordered your own tray? How did that go? This is a loaded question, as Dad hates to wrestle with his cardiac, renal, and diabetic dietary restrictions on that god-awful hospital menu. I found a few things I can live with. He is being coy, and I decide to hold off on the interrogation, as we will see soon enough what he selected. With the computer-calculated metrics on each and every item so carefully calibrated, his options are so pitifully limited that even chicken noodle soup is off the table. My nerves jangle as the day wears on, and when the tray comes, I am fit to be tied. It contains 5 desserts. I do not know how the old man gamed the system, but he found a loophole that provided him with his heart's desire. I was irate. I don't know why, if I was so sure this was the end. Why fight the man on his deathbed on 5 desserts? It was probably more calories in that one meal than he had eaten in any 2 days combined that month. I gave him a really hard time. He was doing it right, despite my best efforts to ruin it for him. Luckily, he was completely ignoring me as he devoured with enthusiasm his chocolate pudding, angel food cake with strawberries, piles of whipped cream. He continued merrily on his culinary journey through the best of what the hospital kitchen had to offer in the form of confections. A chocolate chip cookie, some sort of apple pie tart, and a cup of orange sherbet. My primary mission for that day, though, was the nebulous concept of quality time, so I pressed on and let the junk food go. The afternoon excitement later ramped up in the form of a nosebleed, a rather epic nosebleed, to be sure. There was a small cough, he blew his nose, as only dads can do with a certain spectacular violence. There was a splutter and then a geyser-like burst of blood. After the initial gunshot to the face appearance, it reduced to a trickle, but we alerted the nurse, who kicked into high gear when she saw the damage. He seemed fine, and things tend to look worse than they are. So after a wipe down, an ice pack, and pressure, the situation was under control, or so it appeared, but still a trickle. 10 minutes go by, then 20, 30, 45, and with his head tilted back, blood was running down his throat. Truth be told, it was more protein than he's had to eat since yesterday, but it was beginning to turn his stomach and mine. We made some vampire jokes, and the nurse called for an ear, nose, and throat specialist. This was valuable blood, currently sprayed all over his top sheet, and he will need every drop tomorrow for open-heart surgery and the many labs still on the agenda for tonight. There is now a full court press to stop the bleeding. The ENT tried conservative solutions at first, various cotton swabs up the nostril to staunch the flow, more enthusiastic ice packing, more pressure, and then an aggressive chemical cautery that involves taking what looks like a spray can of expanding foam insulation and firing in the hole to fill the available space. The foam solidifies and completely blocks the airway on one side and closes off the blood vessels. It is horrendously unpleasant. We all stood around, mouths agape as the scene unfolded. The doctor with a knee hiked up on the bed, hunched over our father. It hurts, it burns, but the bleeding stops. The expanding foam did the trick. Dad can now taste the chemicals in the back of his mouth. He can smell it with his one good nostril, and the pressure is enormous. His nose looks comically bulbous on one side. It is funny and crazy and a little horrible. We chuckle self-consciously in the presence of the staff, but laugh for real when they leave. He is under no circumstances allowed to blow his nose again, which is the single most desired thing in his entire life for the remainder of the day. We kid, we distract, and we sneak every box of tissue out of his line of sight. It's going to be a very long night.
My name is Heather Hobbs. I'm not in the writing group. I just am a longtime National Novel Writing Month participant. This is part of a short story that's about 2,000 words. I think I could probably get through a third to a half of it in 5 minutes. I'm going to censor a few things because there are children. Okay. It's called $5 a Day. Sometimes John remembers her face. He knows it looks different now, the face of a woman, not the angry scowl of a teenager. She was a good woman, he repeats, though the repetition doesn't make it any less or any more true. It doesn't mean she can hear him, but in strange moments of clarity, it feels like she can. If he says those words over and over again, she will hear its pulse like a heartbeat and accept the apology. He sits with his back against a building and holds his possessions tight. An electric Alesis keyboard hemorrhaging screws, a holy Bible, a pocket full of paper-thin restaurant napkins, a sweater that feels like skin, a jacket not warm enough for the weather, and a few years without proper medication. Two women complain about the coming snow. He will have to go to one of the churches where they let them sleep in the lobby and in the pews, row after row like cradled babies. He asks the complaining women for bus money. If he calls it money for a sandwich, sometimes they buy him one. When he wants cash, he has to call it bus money. He has to have a home to go back to. They have to think maybe he's day drunk and somewhere there's a woman ready to holler at him and whip his butt into shape, take his pants and underwear and shirt into the wash to get rid of the smell he can mostly ignore and the memory he can't, the warmth lingering before turning cool and drying hard against his skin. If he smells too bad, people give him a wide berth. They won't give him bus money. Instead, they think of him on the bus where they have to sit. But people don't carry bus money much anymore. They use their phones. What will he do when they all do that? If he has to ride the bus, he gets on the one with the woman driver. She pretends not to see him sneaking on through the back door, his dry hands pushing past the paying customers before taking a seat that makes some of them scoot away. He asks two black teenage boys for bus money, and they pretend not to see him until they are far past, the taller one hurrying the other along. He asks a white woman with a daughter who looks like Rochelle for bus money, but she doesn't turn around. He asks a crowd of Mexican ladies for dinero, and one of them puts three singles in his paper cup, followed by another who drops in a few pieces of change. He pockets the money without counting it, and then there is a long stretch where no one passes. His fingers press the Alesis's keys down, and they give in easily. It's been that way for a long time now, the rattling, too, when he tilts it from one side to the other. People used to stop on the street and listen, sometimes toss their change into the cup he carried for that purpose, but now they pass without looking, like they can't hear the music, can't appreciate it anymore. They've got headphones now, those little ones that don't need a cord to connect. They don't listen to the rhythm of the city. How they walk without hearing what's ahead and what's behind, he doesn't know. That's why he settled on asking. He doesn't like it much, makes him feel like a beggar. When they'd pay him for his songs, now that was a job, that was an honest wage. He blows his nose and slicks his hair back with it. The sidewalk under him is cold. Maybe he should get a new sign. Sometimes there are bad days too, wet days when he fits the keyboard behind him under an awning to keep it dry. Days he doesn't remember himself for big parts of them, just listens to the stories coming out of his mouth. It feels better this way, the lost part of him asking the other to tell those same lines again and again. He's seen some things, too. He lets his eyes see them, but he keeps them from telling the rest of him. Like the man who jumped in ahead of the L, papers floating up behind him. The awful sound of impact, the screeching, the screams. The police closed off everything, but too late because his eyes already saw what sprayed up. It makes him feel terrible going down those steps. When he has to for the cold, he watches each of the faces and their bodies. Behind the yellow line, he sometimes yells too loud like he works there. I'm watching you, he tells any teenager standing alone and looking emptied out. Because he has to watch so intently, he can't play there anymore. He can't ask for bus money after paying for the train. He can only ride it back and forth.
I could stop there.
My name's Ann Anderson, and I'm one of the people in the writing group. And this is actually part of what I wrote during Nano this year, so it's not totally polished, but I figured I'd read it anyways. I'll give you the setup. This is earlier in the story. And Karen is a Navy surgeon who now works with the Pentagon as an attaché to NATO. She's at a meeting in Georgia, Tbilisi, Georgia. And she overhears a conversation between a young American lawyer and the Russian delegation where they plan to meet. And being an amateur spy, she decides to go there and see what she could see. So she stops by the pub and somehow ends up alone with the Russian colonel. He held back the curtain for her as she ducked under his arm to tug open the back door. An icy wind struck her head on and whipped her hair around her face. Frozen air worked its way under the gap of her collar. She turned from too warm to ice cold in a moment, except where a warm hand rested on the small of her back. This is such a bad shut up. What was wrong with dinner? He was right. They were here to cross-pollinate. God, this was such a bad idea. Nobody knew where she was. Well, that wasn't true. She still had her phone. I have a car up here somewhere. He led her down between houses, an alley so narrow a horse and rider couldn't fit. The streets here are impossible. She said, you know, I think that's your fault. He stopped, looked down at her, maybe 7 inches taller than her and a few more, standing on the high side of the sloping street. You blame everything on us? You know the history here? Not that part. He put his hand at her back and led her to walk ahead of him. The Persians burned the city in 1795. They burned the entire country. Do you know why they attacked? Because it was Thursday and they had nothing to do? Yes, of course, I forgot that part. Because their king allied with Russia, they walked out to a much wider road. Modern streetlights illuminated shops on either side. So Russia's responsible. They were forced to rebuild the city in bits and pieces. I did not know that. Which way? Up there, the blue one. He gestured at the Ford Fiesta, parked against the side of the bakery, an empty space now on her back. I hope it starts, he said. Great. And to this day, Russia and Georgia remain good friends, a happy ending. She frowned up at him, but found him smiling wryly. If that's what you need to tell yourself. They stopped at the car. She leaned against it as he searched his pocket for the key. What did NATO do to help them when we retaliated against their attack on us? The Georgian attacks. And the shooting starts. NATO did nothing. You complain about UN peacekeepers. Where's your report on the impotence of NATO? She watched his face, not particularly bothered by their conversation, but alertly watching cars speed past. Let's get in the car. She walked around and climbed in. It started easily. He grinned. I was worried. Really? No, not really. He grinned and pulled out behind the next car. You notice how fast they drive here? They drive fast everywhere. The only place that drivers are courteous is in the U.S. He said, I agree with that, she said. Oh, look, our first agreement. She laughed, more than the comment warranted. There aren't many people who get my jokes, he said. God, the guy was attractive. Confidence. She relaxed back into the seat, and he wound down towards the city. She asked, are we going out for food? No, he said simply. Oh, I'm bringing you back to my hotel room. Her whole body responded, and she tried hard to keep him from noticing her breathing. Where are you staying? It's not a problem. We can walk in through the kitchen. You've done this before? You really want me to answer that? She watched the street lamps flash past one after one after one. Yes. Not with a woman. You're bisexual? He laughed. That's a question I've never been asked. No, I don't always need to be seen leaving the hotel. Keep them guessing. Who is them? Everyone eventually watches the Russians. You can't guarantee the back way is clear. It's safe. We control the hotel. Damn, I can't do this. He stopped for a red light. They were the only car at the intersection. He looked over at her, his silvery eyes in the darkness. He whispered, "Trust me." She said, "This is how you compromise people, just like this. Yes, look how well it works. If I lose my job over this..." "You won't lose your job. You'll be arrested for treason. Please, your humor is killing me."
Hi, I'm Isabel Alexander. I'm also part of the writing group here at the Splains. I'm going to read a poem first that I wrote during this NaNoWriMo. It's titled Abundance. Depart from me, thoughts of lack and limitations. Your amorphous need to conquer no longer wields power. I'll manifest my dreams planted by God into my heart, resonating at higher vibrations, the frequency of love, abundance, health, and wholeness. Crocheted in desolated red, black, and white, my life. The past pains with their trickling vermilion blood, the darkness of storm clouds that overtake a downcast spirit, the innocence and light still radiating, though near snuffed out by grief and betrayal, comprise the times of yesterday, but today irradiates and reflects. His magnificence inside me grows when I allow its brightness to escape, gravitating toward a serene existence. I force my ego to crash, break into pieces to allow God to work through me. As his extension, I breathe, love, persevere in this physical plane, and in the next phase, purified by the hurts of the world. I am a child of God. He breathed his life force into my lungs. Through his knowledge, I am secure, and I thrive in his perfection.
Thank you. And these are two very short excerpts from Cherry Pie, a novella that I've been working on. Sadie squeezes herself even smaller and looks down on her hands. "I was driving his car and..." "Whose car?" "It doesn't matter," she barked at Noemi. "Does it?" "Yes, if you're going to tell me about his car, then I need to know who he is." "His hands were greasy on most days I met him. The first time was the summer before. He didn't provoke me or anything. He just wanted to check out my brooch." "Your brooch?" A guy wanted to take a closer look at the piece of jewelry. Sounds unreal, but also intriguing. "Who is he?" Noemi decides not to ask again. "What's the point? The ghost will not answer anyway. It's best to just listen to her story, and then maybe she'll forget about the cherry pie." There's another part. "He didn't know what was true anymore. On the surface, everything seemed normal, but underneath it all, there was a nagging sensation of wrongness, something sinister. He cast the phone onto the sofa and shuffled into the kitchen. He doesn't have to celebrate Thanksgiving. Turkey only makes everyone sleepy. Through the small window, a glum winter afternoon's grayish light seeped in to illuminate the yellow walls. The clock's small hand moved with a clicking sound, monotonous. 4:30. He should take a nap now, but his stomach growled, demanding some type of nourishment. Since when it happened the first time, his sleep-wake cycle has been way off. By 1 a.m., the witching hour, he wanted to be wide awake and prepared for anything. He opened the fridge and grabbed a carton of eggs, a bunch of shallots, and a stick of butter. Cracking open 3 eggs, he wondered about the silhouette appearing on his bedroom wall on most nights for 2 months now. Was it the shadow of a sentient being? He didn't know. When he left the room, it disappeared. Then the girl stood at the end of the hallway with the lights on, but when he advanced toward her, she vanished, as if vaporized. Beep, beep. He tried ignoring the sound, pacing back and forth in the cramped kitchen. Was he imagining things? Maybe he should go see Dr. Greenberg. He could put an end to all of this. That's it.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Chris. This is the opening to my work on From National Novel Writing Month this year, so it's kind of rough, but I want to read it anyway. James did not want to go into the room. He didn't even want to be here at all. Every time he heard a machine beep, he felt his blood run a little colder. Every time he smelled the antiseptic smells so common in hospitals, he had to fight the urge to run, but he couldn't run away. To do that would have made him a coward, and as much as he might want to, he couldn't be a coward. Not today. Not in front of him. He breathed slowly, trying to calm his racing heart. Breathe in, breathe out. His hands were shaking. He clenched his fists and then unclenched them. He opened the door into the room. Hey, Dad. James had to fight back the tears that threatened to flood out of him. It wasn't easy. Looking at his dad, the strongest pillar he had known in his 15 years, looking so weak and frail lying in that bed, made him want to lose it. Thomas Quinn wasn't supposed to look like this. He was supposed to be tall and brawny, not small and skeletal. His hands were supposed to be tanned and calloused from working with the roofing tiles all day, not pale with an IV tube stuck in him. And his hair. He had always been so proud of his short, cropped brown hair and the thick and ever-present beard. Lately, a little bit of gray had been showing up in there, but he'd always done his best to laugh it off. Whenever James had given him a hard time about his hair color, he had just shrugged and said, "Well, that's the price I paid for living this long. You'll have to pay that price too one day." But there wasn't any gray anymore. There barely was any hair at all anymore. He didn't have much of a price left to pay. The one thing that kept James sane, looking at his father like that, the one thing that reminded him that the person he was looking at was still his father, were his eyes. His vibrant green eyes still had the same observant and intelligent sparkle that they always had. His body might be going, but his mind was still there. At least it seemed that way. That was something. Or at least James told himself that. "Hey, kiddo, don't just stand there. Come over and give your big man a hug." James didn't need to be told twice. He ran over and hugged his dad. Gingerly. He didn't give him the bear hug he wanted to give, and his dad's hug back that wasn't that strong either. But it worked. "Don't take this the wrong way, son. Was it just you today? I thought your mom and sister were coming too," his dad asked. Eyebrows, or rather the part of his face where his eyebrows had been, raised in question. "About that," James said sheepishly. James recounted the story of his 11-year-old sister's exploits against a would-be schoolyard bully earlier that day. Apparently, Gina had managed to defend herself so successfully that by the time the teachers managed to separate the two warring parties, it had been quite hard to tell who was bullying who. Gina had a bunch of people ready to back her up, but their mom had still had to go down to have a meeting with the teacher. So mom doesn't think Gina will be in any real trouble, but so they should be by later tonight, James explained. But he didn't think his dad heard him. The old man was too busy trying not to bust the gut laughing. "That is great. Jesus. Your mother and I really taught that girl well," he said, tears streaming down his face. James grinned. He didn't know if the knowledge that his little sister possessed a keen fighting ability and an intense desire to use it was really such a good and funny thing, but anything that kept his dad's spirits up was fine by him. "You know, one of the things I was worried about most was that I wouldn't be around when she finally started dating. I don't think I have to worry about that, actually," his dad said. James felt his smile falter. He tried to recover, smiling twice as much. But he should have known. You don't fool Thomas Quinn. As far as James was concerned, that was the unofficial 11th commandment. "Listen, bud, it might actually be a good thing your mom's not here. There's a story I've always wanted to tell you, but I never could because your mom would have killed me if I ever said it." "What?" James asked. He knew his father was manipulating him, trying to get him to stop dwelling on the sickness. James didn't mind. His mind could use some manipulating at the moment. "Well, it's the story of how your mom and I met. You know, like that old TV show, except a lot shorter. Maybe you found it weird we never told you how we met. Maybe you were grateful we never told you. And most likely you didn't care one way or the other. Guilty," James thought. "But you really should care, because it's a really funny story involving my college friend's bachelor party, her sister's bachelor party, a partially destroyed bar, and my ticked-off police captain of an uncle," his father said, nodding proudly. James just stared at him in shock. "Oh, yeah. Before we became your parents, your mother and I had stories, both independently and later with each other." "Everyone does. Even the people you wouldn't expect," he smiled and pointed at him. "I know that you don't put as much stock on writing your own story as much as some of the other kids your age have. Honestly, that's fine. As a parent, I really don't mind that. It'll make your mom's life easier going forward, too." "Dad," James said, uncomfortable with the topic. But his dad weakly held his hand up, asking for and getting silence. He wasn't done. But every once in a while, James, you need to be a little wild. You need to create a story that you're going to want to look back on and tell. No one was meant to be completely wrapped up in their own mind forever. It doesn't have to be parties. You could skydive, bungee jump, backpack the world, anything. But you have to be ready and willing to act. And who knows how those actions will pay off. Look at me. I had some fun that, honestly, when you say it out loud, really shouldn't have been that fun. But it worked out for me. I met your mother. I had you, your sister. Our family exists simply because your mother and I were both crazy at a moment that counted. James stayed silent for a moment. Well, like you said, I don't exactly get off on being wild. How does someone who isn't used to being wild know when that right moment is? His father shrugged again, despite the effort. You just will. I knew it that night. Even before the night was over, before your mother gave me her number, I knew I was in the middle of something special. I was on the edge of a knife, and I needed to listen to my instincts and make this count. I knew that I would regret this moment for the rest of my life if I blew it. And I would have. So I have to wait for the moment when my brain shuts down on me and my guts wants to take over? Oh yeah, that sounds like a real recipe for success, James said. He didn't want to disagree openly with his father while he was in this state, but what he was saying didn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to James. Thomas looked into his son's face and could see that there wasn't any understanding there. He sighed. Clearly you think the drugs are going to my brain, wise guy, but trust me. One day something will happen to you, or you'll meet somebody, or whatever, and everything I'm saying to you right now will make sense. Uh-huh. James wasn't really convinced. Thomas gave his son a pointed stare before coughing. Fine, I'll hold off on any further life lessons. For now. In the meantime, would you still like to hear the embarrassing story of how your mom and I met? James grinned. Yes, that story did sound promising. He loved his mom, but he wouldn't mind having some stronger ammunition to use against her. Adults had years of experience on their side. Every teenager needed some stronger ammo when fighting on that playing field. All right, then. Here, take some money, Thomas said, reaching over to his wallet on the table next to him, pulling out a five. And get me a drink of water from that vending machine down the hall. Dying here. James couldn't help but chuckle at the dark humor. Get yourself something, too. James smiled and walked out of the room. This was going better than he'd thought. He hadn't cried, like he was afraid he might. His dad wouldn't have minded, he knew. But he would have. His dad was more energetic than he'd seen him in a while. James knew that didn't mean he was actually getting better, but at least for a moment or two, he could pretend.
All right, this is Maggie again. This is a 99% true story, so this one is pure memoir, not so much fiction, from the same manuscript, and this is unedited, so I hadn't planned to do a second piece, so bear with me. The Goat Story. Well, at least you have that nice check coming from the government, the neighbor could be overheard saying. What did he say? Aunt Eva hisses in an astonished whisper. I think he just said they'll be glad to have that check coming from the government. For Johnny. What? The nerve of some people. A man has died, for crying out loud, says another cousin at the small cluster of family members clucks and titters in anger and incredulity. The conversation drifted between rooms among sounds of tinkling glasses, silverware, and hushed conversation. It was the funeral luncheon for Dad's Uncle Johnny, his namesake, who was killed overseas at war. An uninvited, persnickety neighbor with lots of opinions and an open mouth was gossiping among the group that at least there was a silver lining to a tragic young death coming in the form of a funeral benefit from the military, barely enough to get him in the ground. Hardly the windfall that Mrs. Needs to Stay on Her Side of the Fence would have everyone believe. She continues to gossip and infuriate before either someone asks her to go or she gives in to her better judgment and makes her retreat. The next day, that neighbor happened by the family homestead on her normal route to the grocery, cutting too close to the property line for no purpose other than to torment the family goat tied up at the stake in the front yard. She stuck her tongue out, leered, and scoffed at the animal, even kicking dirt in its direction as it munched benignly on the grass, causing it to skitter away. Then she gave a sickeningly sweet fake smile to Grandpa as she rounded the corner of the house and just noticed him sitting out on the porch. When she was out of sight of the front porch and on her merry way, Grandpa set his tobacco pipe on the front windowsill, hoisted his bulk out of the rocking chair, and squirted a stream of spit off to the side on his way to the goat's stake. With a whisper to the goat and a groan to his joints, he bent and yanked the stake up out of the dirt and scooted it about a foot and a half further from the house. "That old witch has a nasty turn coming. You gonna show her what's what, ain't you, my boy?" he said as he kicked some dirt onto that old stake hole. After a while, the old battle axe came back up the lane with her purchases in tow, a full paper sack aloft in each arm. This time, the goat was not interested in standing idly by as she directed her foolishness at him. He paused in his chewing and pivoted his body a bit to keep his eyes on the neighbor as she came more fully into view. She was humming as she skated just inside the boundaries of the front yard, shaving a few precious inches off of her commute. No matter, she was plenty close. As she glanced over, making her customary harumph in the goat's direction, it locked eyes with her, and she almost retreated in fear, then remembered the safe length of rope as she had tested it and the goat's congeniality many times before. So instead of walking on, she paused for a pair of seconds and doubled down, jeering at it, making ugly expressions with her voice and face. The goat pawed at the earth with a front hoof and exhaled through flared nostrils like a bull. Then, without further warning, the goat charged at her. Still feeling safe and smug, the neighbor turned her back on the goat just as it reached her and connected his horned head with her ample backside. Oof. She yowled in pain and surprise as her legs were scooped out from under her, grocery bags flung high into the air. Produce packages and cans scattered all across the yard, and nosy neighbor landed on her rump in the dust. Grandpa could hardly contain his merriment as the old meanie got her just desserts, so he didn't bother holding back the giggles. "My goods," she exclaimed. "You'll pay me for these things. You're goat damaged." Grandpa took a wheezy breath. "As I sees it, ma'am, you're trespassing on my property and may have concussed my old watchdog here in the process. You best be picking up your littering as well, and in a hurry, for my friend gets a mind to say hello to your hindquarters again." He nudged his chin towards the goat, who had begun to munch on a scuffed bunch of grocery carrots. "Here's a nickel for them there," Grandpa said as he flicked a coin into the grass next to the neighbor lady and began to howl with laughter once again.
So I'm back again. Okay, I have a short poem and the beginning of a nonfiction after that. Okay. Winterland. Your breath, like vapor, swirls around you in the freezing air. Icicles suspended from slumbering trees. Myriads of intricate crystals illuminate the streets, glimmering on rooftops, and shield the dying grass. Snow flurries circling down from the heavens strive to paint this world the whitest white, like angels' wings, mellifluous and bright. You smile, admiring the kiss of frost, glittering diamonds of wonders, sequencing evergreen trees, orange, red, and yellow leaves caught by winter's maddening winds. Each season lives its abundant beauty and purpose, and with the shivering cold comes a warm blanket of snow for the land to survive and thrive, and for us all. And this is the excerpt. Just the beginning, short part of a nonfiction I'm working on. I don't have a title yet. I was 5 when we first traveled to Budapest, the capital of Hungary, 180 kilometers from the tiny village where I grew up. We took the train. My father was an expert taking the train because he worked far, away from home, leaving on Mondays and usually coming home on Fridays. But when I think of the experience of visiting the big city, I don't recall the train ride. What I remember is standing by the Danube, the river that splits Buda and Pest, standing with a slice of watermelon in my hand and watching the juice trickle down on the front of my dress. My throat still tightens in fear. The stern push of his hand is imprinted on my back, and even now that I taught myself to swim, I still am terrified of falling in. The water churned, and I could see myself in that moment being carried away, drowning. Thank you.
Hi, it's Julie again, and I'm reading a magical realism story called Signs. Helen knelt with her hands folded and her eyes closed in a chapel of a cloister in Salamanca, Spain, 2 hours before Vespers, while Aunt Ruby drank tea with the nuns. The cloister, with unassuming wooden doors, lacked any carvings of men with pointed hats or halos, or demons clawing at naked bodies. Helen would have walked right past the 2-floor stone dwelling had it not been for Aunt Ruby, who lived there a long time ago. "Maybe I'll be a nun," Helen had mentioned. Her aunt replied that Helen was still young. But many saints joined at a much younger age than 17. Some even led an army. As she knelt in the stone chapel that held a statue of the Virgin Mary, and to her right, the child Jesus, with his hand raised as if shyly wanting to ask the nuns a question. Decisions had never been easy for Helen, but she felt compelled to know whether she should join an order. Helen silently recited, "Our Father, who art in heaven," her eyes tight as she pleaded for a sign. "Hallowed be thy name." She opened her eyes as the statue of Jesus mouthed the words, "Thy kingdom come." His mouth moved again, surely a sign. "What should I do?" she begged of the child. "Take me out into the courtyard before the sisters enter. I long to be outside." The chapel's stone walls reflected the midday sun's rays. Seeing no one behind her and alone amongst the pews, she stood in front of Jesus. "I'll get caught. Pick me up and follow me." Helen did as she was told, and taking the child into her arms, she swung the wooden door open and descended the spiral steps wide enough for her, adjusting the cradled statue so it would not scrape against the stone wall. "Through this door and set me on the bench." Helen obeyed, relieved to lighten her arms from the child, worried to scrape the bottom against the concrete bench. She didn't look at him, only sat beside him as they both looked at the patch of green grass no bigger than the floor of her bedroom at home. The wind carried a scent with it, and Helen followed it to an apricot tree that grew in the corner of the courtyard. "Why must you ask for signs?" the child Jesus sighed. Helen turned to face him, the paint chipping and revealing the terracotta beneath. His lips remained closed and his eyes focused in front of him, not on her. "It's a big decision to make, whether to be a nun or a mother, a wife, a scientist, a traveler. I just don't know what to be." To her own ears, Helen sounded like a whining toddler. She stood and glanced at the child. "Do you mind if I eat an apricot?" She accepted his silence as an invitation to find the ripened fruit and pluck it. Soft and sweet, she took a bite and sat back down and offered some to him. She accepted his silence as a no thank you. A few threads clung to the pit, and Helen tossed it onto the grass where it vanished between the blades. "It is time," he said. She nodded and lifted the child into her arms, careful that no apricot juice would cling to him, up the stairs and through the doors until she returned him to the right of his mother. Helen stood and began to recite the Our Father, but his lips didn't move. He remained still with his one hand raised and his terracotta crown centered perfectly on his head. The doors opened and Helen's aunt stepped in with her friend, who, dressed in her traditional habit, asked her, "Would you like to be a nun one day?" Helen's eyes opened wide. She suppressed the urge to laugh and cry, managing to shake her head as she ran down the main stairs and out onto the cobbled street.
All right, back to the homeless man. I'm Heather again, by the way. After a while, he gets up from his spot and follows the road forward. He is hungry, but it's the kind he's used to. There's a busy place where trucks serve food at lunch, and he sits there, eyes on the trash, in case someone throws theirs out without finishing it. No one does, but within the hour, someone brings him tacos. When he looks up to thank them, it's the owner of one of the trucks. "We had these extra." He notices then that some of the trucks have already left, taking away their smoky, spicy smells, frying grease and meat. This man has on a pair of blue glasses too big for his face and a yellow hat pulled low on his forehead. The man, who he realizes is now more of a boy, gives him a bottle of Gatorade, the lime green one. "God bless," he tells the man. The words roll off his tongue on impulse, but he knows they like it, the people who give. They like to get something back, and a small blessing is easy. He begins to eat without feeling the taste on his tongue at all, only the warmth of it.
The tortillas get gooey in his hands, but he licks them clean. They will carry that smell for the rest of the day. In some past life, he bought his own tacos. Sour cream and guacamole, margarita with a salty rim, flavored lime like the Gatorade. He drinks half after the salty food, but carries the rest under his armpit for later. He finds a quiet place and composes a song that has the same texture as the taco man, the same youthful look hiding all the other things. It's always winter when he wants to find Rochelle. John wonders if he ever passed her on the street without recognizing her. In the train station's bathroom mirror, he sees his face from time to time, and he doesn't think that Rochelle would recognize him. Two strangers in a city full of them. When he reaches the church, it's still closed. He sits on the stairs beside it, wondering how long until the pastor will come. He's a man with the look of another place, but John understands him when he talks, so he guesses the man was born here. The parents are the ones from somewhere else. While he waits, he sets the keyboard on his legs, stretches them out. He presses the keys down, humming along. He goes through the old set list, the whole thing, even though none of the people who pass would know it. Even if he forgets the words sometimes, his fingers remember the rest. Now, if the guitar and the bass and the drummer were here, they could do it right. But like his daughter, he's also lost track of the band. When the pastor arrives with the church ladies in tow carrying steaming casserole dishes, he has made it through the set twice. All those old memories under the spotlight, getting his drinks for free and a cut of the door to bring home to Martha and Rochelle. Evening, the man says to him, and the keys jingle. He says it back and then stands to follow them in. "You're early," one of the women says. She has on a gray jacket and a scarf that covers her mouth. The other woman hands him a bag of hotel toiletries. "Wash up for dinner," she tells him. "You know this is God's table, and we all better look it." She grins, and there's pink lipstick on her front tooth. He leans the keyboard against the bathroom wall. There's a shower, and when he comes out of it, his clothes are gone, and in their place are others. He towels off, and the towel smells like fabric softener, and he wants to keep it with him always. The new clothes are warmer than his, and the pastor tells him that he threw them in the wash, and he can have them back when they're dry. John nods and takes a seat in the pew. His hair is still wet, but his nose has stopped running after he cleaned it in the shower, and he feels like a fresh new baby waiting to meet the Lord. Others come. He recognizes them like they recognize him. He sits with the keyboard and plays and plays. They sit down to dinner on plastic chairs in the basement once everyone is clean. After, they pass out mats that smell like laundry. He sleeps with the keyboard beside him and wakes when the others start to stir, when the church ladies come back and the smell of cinnamon and maple oatmeal fills the room. Up on the wall, Jesus hangs suspended from a cross. The crown and the cross and the trickles of blood that trail into his eyes and down his arms are made of the same stuff. It makes him think of that hymn, that old rugged cross, and he knows the keys for it. He's still playing when the pastor sits alongside. "Need some fresh batteries?" he asks. He might as well take them where he can get them. The pastor has a little screwdriver, and he uses it to pry the remaining screw off the back of the keyboard, the other gone somewhere along a roadway. He examines the contents inside and says, "Wait here," like John has some other place to be. All that water would damage the keyboard outside. He hasn't kept it for 10 years after losing his boots and jacket, after losing the pocket knife that used to be his father's one night when sleeping at a home, after losing his family, just to get it wet. The pastor comes back and slots the batteries in before twisting the screw back into place. He must have found another one somewhere because he sticks it in the empty hole too. When he flips it back over, the keyboard doesn't make that same broken thing rattle it used to. He presses the on switch in the top corner and it lights up blue. John changes the setting to classic piano and he plays the hymn. The new batteries have a sound that's whole. He can feel it moving through his whole body. The pastor recognizes the tune and some of the church ladies start to sing as he plays. Into the verses, they still know the words. They know all of the words. His fingers find the chords beneath and around the melody, hold them down. Some of the other guests are watching. When there aren't any more verses, he repeats the first one again, and some of the guests join in too. The sound of it all filling up the church goes on, and he can remember a different church where he sat behind a wood piano he tuned before every service. Keys that would tune but not stay there, like something born to wander. Rochelle and Martha watching him from the third pew until suddenly they weren't anymore. Or maybe they were still there and he was the one who was gone. John's face is wet, but he plays that first verse again, and he wonders if somewhere that piano is still singing those same hymns out of tune, wondering who would notice.
Okay, Anne Anderson. I'm Anne Anderson. I'm going to read a short nonfiction piece. It's called Antarctica. I love a dead man I've never met. Although in my mind he's not dead, he's just outside. Maybe sleeping in his canvas tent, or maybe he's looking after the dogs. He was here only 100 years ago, but seems so near. I need him to help me understand. The Antarctic gale whipped so hard against the side of the tent that the wind made a snare drum of the fly. The noise of it blasted straight through earplugs and woke me from sound sleep. My tentmate's name was Anne, like mine. Her blue eyes crinkled sweetly as she laughed and was, like Robert Falcon Scott, from England. I, like Roald Amundsen, came from Norway. We wondered if we should be sharing a tent. Anne and I spent the night in a bright yellow North Face dome tent like the ones they use on Everest and in all those post-apocalyptic movies. We planted the pegs horizontally and stepped them down hard under a layer of snow. Then we tightened the guy lines of both the tent and the covering fly, taut as guitar strings. After that, we heaped snow along the base to bury the edges of the fly to keep the Antarctic winds from sweeping up between the fly and the tent and lifting the whole thing up in the air. I'd read about the wind down here, picking up a 300-pound iron lid and dropping it 50 feet away, just missing one of Robert Falcon Scott's men. Midnight showed us a sky completely different from anything I've ever seen. I'm no astronomer, but still look up often enough to recognize the Two Dippers and Orion's Belt. I've seen the Milky Way now and then, too, and wherever I've been in the Northern Hemisphere, the sky looks pretty much like itself. But looking up from here, I felt far from home. The stars weren't in the right place. The North Star was missing, replaced by a strange group they call the Southern Cross. It didn't look so much like a cross, more it seemed a diamond. The song by Crosby, Stills, and Nash kept playing in my head and made a little familiar connection between me and that strange sky. But still, they weren't my stars. What was mine was the Milky Way. I'd never seen it like this. The Milky Way I knew seemed a deer trail through the sky compared to this 6-lane superhighway at rush hour. It lit up the night. Even the Magellanic clouds, 2 dwarf galaxies orbiting the Milky Way, were easy to see. Reminded me of why I'd come, of why I stood here, of exactly what those explorers from 100 years ago saw when they looked up. Nothing had changed in the sky since then. Nothing but the International Space Station, of course. But they were just another set of bright lights on this big road. Ernst Shackleton looked up at these stars, not just at their beauty, but for survival. He could never imagine that someone like me would no longer need to use them for navigation, that someone like me would stand here warm and dry and well-fed and look up only for the pleasure of it, and then be back home in a week or two without frostbite or any of the unimaginable suffering those men experienced. I felt spoiled, embarrassed, awed by attempting to compare our circumstances. Then the cool wind started pushing me along, or I would have stayed there most of the night memorizing the sky from the bottom of the world. I snuggled down into my deliciously warm sleeping bag as the walls beat around me. I think about Ernst Shackleton out in that wind. I consider who he might have been, who the man Ernst actually was. What kind of man leads men through such hardship? He lived on open sea ice for 2 years in simple canvas tents, reindeer skin sleeping bags wet from melting ice, no way to bathe, dried peas, pemmican, penguins. And all his men survived. They waited on a small strip of beach while Ernest and a few others sailed in a small boat over 3,000 miles across the wildest ocean on the planet, through storms that obscured navigation landmarks in the sky. Biologically, he and I aren't different. As Carl Sagan said, we're both made of the stuff of stars. But who was this man? I can't begin to scratch his surface. Ernst Shackleton, so much more than me, made of stuff I can't even imagine.
This one is titled Buzzkill. Apparently, I'm a buzzkill. I'm the dasher of dreams, the Debbie Downer, the one who does not support brilliant ideas and opportunities. At least that was the latest declaration by my middle child, who's now a 26-year-old man, living 1,300 miles away in Florida. He lives with the constant swings of bipolar disorder. The other day, one of his manic highs, he decided he was going to make millions flipping property. He found someone called a hard money lender, who will finance the purchase of the property and sign a contract, where at the sale he gives him all the cash purchase money plus a $50,000 profit. He immediately found a property in a high, lavish area selling for $150,000 with potential to resell for over $300,000. Sounds great, but, and here comes Debbie Downer, I had the audacity to suggest he bring in an inspector to check out the property before he jumped into the deep end of the pool. Maybe I'm being negative, but I doubt an owner of a home that can sell for over $300,000 would sell for half unless something was drastically wrong. Since my son has never owned a home and his repair skills are limited to a two-week stint in house building 5 years ago, where he put up some drywall, roof shingles, 2x4s for walls, he has no knowledge of the big-ticket items, electrical, plumbing, or the ever-present tropical scourge of termites. Without a trained professional to estimate the true damage of the property, how could he determine the realistic cost of repairs to make it sellable for a profit? Logical, right? Instead of being grateful for my sage advice, I'm accused of destroying his dreams. I never support him, and I don't believe in him. He's all alone in the world with no support from his parents, his wife, or his brothers. I admire his unrelentless enthusiasm. He takes risks that pay off, but at the same time, he's taking chances that I'm uncomfortable with. He does not see the whole picture. He never thinks any farther than the massive payout. Little details like the idea that a dirt-cheap house in an affluent area just might be ridden with wood-eating termites and require a teardown rather than a rehab just don't cross his mind. It's his magical, manic thinking that makes him unstoppable, but leaves him unprotected for the fall when reality crashes down. From 1,300 miles away, I have to talk him out of the depths of his depression, show him life is worthwhile, prove he's worthy of love, and that life still holds great possibilities. I have to make him see the one thing I have learned in half a century of living. There's always tomorrow.
So I'm Janine Matizen, and this story is a fantasy short story, but the rest is, it's too long to read the whole thing, so I'll just read the first section, and it's called Assault on the Stars. Magically bred kittens, read the sign. Keeping one isn't for the faint of heart, the dumpy woman told Aro. She was covered in cat hair. At her feet lay a wicker basket filled with frolicking, meowing kittens. Very special, these. The black-as-night mother cat rubbed against Aro's leg. She jostled a handful of iron Rylia coins, thoughtfully, surveying the kittens. Well, so am I, Aro said, just as the only black kitten of the group caught her gaze. She reached down and gently picked him up. Right away, he wriggled out of her grasp and started climbing her shoulder. His claws were as sharp as glass shards, but she laughed a bit as he attempted to clamber on top of her hood. Aro lowered the kitten and noticed silver glinting in his dark, thick fur. It wasn't a collar, but ran down his chest before becoming hidden by his stomach fur. It gleamed in the sun. A zipper, she thought, eyebrows creasing. You want that kitten? The woman began shifting from foot to foot and almost imperceptibly took a step backwards. She stared at Aro in disbelief and puzzlement before bending down to the basket. This one can turn invisible and move over. This one can change colors. Aro eyed the zipper of the black kitten. He was looking at her again, piercingly. "Look, miss," the seller pushed herself up. "Let me offer you a better deal. Any one of these other furballs, for free. Nobody deserves him." The black kitten leapt to Aro's shoulder before she could stop him and offered his rear end for viewing pleasure. "This guy looks the definition of special, if you ask me." Aro tried not to laugh too hard at the expression on the woman's face. "Well, we specials should stick together." She handed over 9 Rylia coins. The woman looked extremely put out, even though Aro had given her an extra coin in thanks. "Have good life, then," the woman mumbled. Aro headed back down the crowded street of Market Row. Tension she didn't realize she had been holding drained out of her, and her step became a little lighter. Soon, this energetic kitten would be disrupting the dominating, stifling silence of her house. He would scratch furniture and maybe even break something. "Silence, goodbye, finally!" A group of children scurried past, glowering in her direction. Aro slowed, and then stopped just outside the bustle of Market Row. Somberness returned. She glanced down at her feet. "I should have appreciated the fact that this lady sold me the kitten at all." Most people, on seeing Aro's appearance, were hesitant to sell their merchandise. Many downright refused. Unconsciously, her hands tightened on her newly bought kitten. He wriggled in her grip. "Ah, by the dragons," she thought. "In this flaming city, you can buy extinct animal bone jewelry, which remembers stuff, color-changing fire that will burn for months on end, containers that can hold Terra and Ishii magic without going bad." She glowered down at her boots. Dark blue fabric boots led up to fabric legs, which led up to her torso, and so on. All one piece of masterful fabric, wrapping her up, simultaneously her clothing and her skin. She was the only person like this in the entirety of the city of N. Someone special, if there ever was one. "So, surely someone like me shouldn't be viewed as strange?" Even her hair was black embroidery thread. The further Aro went down the street, the heavier the silence became until it almost pressed on her shoulders like a physical weight. Then, as her thoughts inevitably did when she was alone, Aro began thinking about wishes, some of the most powerful magics. If I had the power to change myself, or to change everyone's thoughts and make them accept me. But, as always, she never got any further than that. Her skin tingled unpleasantly, and her feet slowed. A power like that could literally warp reality. The kitten squirmed. Could it sense her discomfort? Aro brought the kitten up to her face and buried her cheek in his fur. "I'm not that crazy," she murmured and hugged it. "At least, I don't think." "Hey," squeaked a voice, and the kitten looked at her with ice blue eyes. "Where are we going? Are we almost there? Will it be warm? Do you have any other cats?" "I hope not. I like being by myself, but Mom said that wouldn't seem appealing." Aro stumbled to a halt at the entrance to an alley, eyebrows shooting up. She stared at him for a moment and then laughed. "Well, if talking was all that lady was worried about, I think I'll be fine." "She never liked me at all," the cat said. "Thanks a lot for buying me, lady. Really." A loud crash came from the dark alley, and then a wooden-sounding thud. Indistinguishable words, tinged with anger, reached Aro and the kitten. She halted. "Ooh, what's that?" The kitten slipped from her grasp and trotted into the shadows. Large ears perked, sniffing the air curiously. Aro blinked for a second, incredulous, then hurried after him. That crash hadn't sounded like anything good, and the voices were getting louder. Within moments, they were in almost total darkness. Aro trailed her hand along the grimy wall, soft fabric feet noiseless on the cobblestones. The kitten's eyes shone golden as he turned to look at something. Quickly, Aro scooped him up. "You know, I think I'll name you Jiko," she hissed as he squirmed and kicked his back feet against her arm. "It's an ancient name, and it means curiosity led the tiny, defenseless kitten into a clearly suspicious alley, and he never saw anyone or anything else ever again, and the only place he could reflect on his stupidity was the afterlife." The kitten nipped her hand and kept on kicking. "I'm not as defenseless as you think. And what are you made of, anyway? The lining to her basket, except without all the clumps of fur?" True irritation reared its head then, and her grip tightened on Jiko. But then, a small distance away, came the scuffling and muffled grunts two men make when they are attempting to restrain each other and be quiet about it. A snarling grunt came into the air like a punch as one of them was shoved against the alley wall. Aro pressed herself and Jiko into the shadows, heart pounding. Jiko stilled, small body tensing out of surprise rather than an obligation to stay hidden. "Don't be an idiot, Jardena," breathed one of the men. He had a damp voice. "All of us have come too far to back out now. This was your idea, or have you forgotten?" There was strained breathing as Jardena, pinned against the wall, struggled to free himself, and a thump as he gave up. His voice sounded as if the grittiness of the alley had come to life. "I'm just reconsidering the security. I don't know about you. But I, Lamont, am not looking forward to having my limbs turned into soup or my five senses bottled up and sent to different parts of the whole blazing country." Silently, Jiko began gnawing at Aro's hand. "The security in that place is the best in the whole city. It's insane." Jardena paused for a second and then tried to say a word which sounded so unfamiliar to him that Aro almost giggled. "Please?" The man called Lamont seethed. "By the dragons! Ugh, can't believe I talked the others into following you. We only have a single shot at this. You still want the Abir Rena, right?" Disdain laced his voice like poison. "Or are they not worth stealing anymore?" Jardena paused once more. Aro took a half step to the right, where the exit to the alley was. If she could just reach it... "No, you're right, Lamont. Let's do this." Lamont's smile was almost palpable in his voice when he next spoke. Aro shuddered, forcing herself onwards. "You made the right choice. The others and I will meet you at the council building at midnight, like we discussed." Lamont released him. Jardena brushed himself off. "Fine. See you then." Aro flattened herself against the wall as Jardena and Lamont strode from the alley, passing within inches of her, and then stalked off in different directions. She waited some minutes, clamping Jiko to her so he wouldn't scamper away, and then dashed from the alley herself. Her mind reeled. She had heard of the enchantments and curses protecting the council building. Most everyone had, but no normal citizen had ever heard before of what lay inside, the real interior, beyond the court and the planning rooms. Fear morphed into jittery excitement. She knew, and she alone. "Knowledge is power, right? Ha! I'm rich! Hey, what are those things that guy was talking about?" Jiko meowed, trying to climb up her arm as she jogged through the streets. Somehow, he managed to hang on as she squeezed past a wagon laden with apples as it trundled creakily to Margaret Row. Aro turned a corner and practically flew through the next street. "Not a clue," she panted. "Okay, not so rich. Above pauper, at least. Are you gonna find out?" Aro looked up past the slate-roofed houses, the looming walls of N's council building, shadowed entire streets, including the one she now ran down. Trees whizzed past her in smudged swirls of emerald and russet. Phoenixes pecking for crumbs on the road fluttered out of her way. "Well," she grabbed Jiko by the scruff of his neck as he almost slipped off. "I know some people who do know. I've worked with them in the past, helped save a group of merchants from an ogre attack." She leapt off a curb. "See, we have to stop those guys from stealing whatever it is." "Why?" "Why?" she scoffed. "Surely your mother told you that stealing is wrong?" "Well," Jiko said, "if it's from people with mean dogs or people with milk or people with yarn and they're not sharing..." Aro ran up the steps of the council building, leaning against a pillar to catch her breath. A few people glowered at her before hurrying away. She tried to pretend their gazes didn't matter. "Okay, fine, so I might get a reward out of it if I do," she hissed, and then wrenched the door open. Almost immediately, she felt like heading back out again in shame. Hadn't buying Jiko been her reward? She'd kept out of people's business for longer than she could stand, and then had forced herself to keep doing it. Many had been ungrateful, even after she'd helped rescue those merchants. They hadn't liked the form that she had been in then. She bit her lip. How could she run after another reward? She walked slowly up to the main desk. It seemed to take forever. Two stained-glassed, floor-to-ceiling windows showered her with vibrant, glistening reds and deep blues. Her heart was pounding louder than usual, but she tried to ignore it. "What's wrong with me? Can I speak to the captain of the guards?" Why was she being so formal? She knew the woman behind the desk. "He's in now, isn't he?" Miss Chisholm nodded and led her into one of the council rooms. Captain Hest had his hands spread out over a map, and the men whom Aro knew to be the most loyal in the force surrounded him. The room had a marble floor and another floor-to-ceiling window. Golden sunlight poured over the men, their ceremonial robes, and all the little pinheads pushed into the map at various sections. "Miss Aro to see you, sir." Captain Hest smiled widely when he saw her. "Well now, 5 months, that's a record." He stroked his auburn beard. "I've got to admit, we all kind of missed you." Jiko leapt onto the table and began delicately sniffing all the large colored pinheads and the arms of the men leaning on the table. The men chuckled, some muttering curiously about his zipper. Aro yearned to catch up with the captain over food and drink, but fear still prickled at the back of her neck. She dove in. "Sir, what are the Abir Rena?" The atmosphere in the room sharpened like a knife. Everyone looked at her. Aro froze for a second. Jiko flopped down onto the map and began gnawing on one of the pinheads, but no one paid him the slightest attention. "It's just, someone's planning to steal them," she said. The captain's expression became utterly serious. He straightened and beckoned to Aro as an equal and unfurled an intricate blueprint of the council building. "You'll be center stage this time."
Good evening. My name's Elena Trufa, and I'm reading Isabel Alexander's flash fiction published by WOW Women on Writing last month. It's entitled Fragments of Bones. The stones, like sandpaper, file away the skin of my palms and scrape my fingers by their rough texture. The sun beats down and the rocks radiate heat like a stove where the fire was set inside before the blaze swallowed the whole house. Fragments of bones and ashes, that's all that is left. My hands are still colored with black. With her ashes condensed into a small coffee canister sitting on my lap, I peer toward the ocean, but can't see the blue waves. Dark clouds moved in to color the sky. I can only imagine how they would reflect the cloudlessness of a hot summer day. Wings flutter above, breaking the tranquil whispering of the wind. My eyes turn toward it, expecting a seagull, but it's a white hawk. The bird lands near me, resting with clawed yellow feet gripping into the veins of the stone. His feathers, like snow, sparkle. The tips of his wings blackened like a night without the moon. If I reach out, I could touch his charcoal beak, as if caressing her face, my wife. "Is it you?" I ask, contemplating the hawk's gaze of coal, yet seeing the green of her irises. His beak turns into her plump red lips. "I loved you." My voice trembles. The bird lifts into the air and wings flapping. He hovers above me for a few moments. Then he flies, soaring high. I place the can in the sand between my feet and stare down on my hands. A dark residue covers them both. Gunpowder. The ballistic report said these hands pulled the trigger. Can it be true? But I'd never fired a gun. I imagine a revolver in my hands, and I watch my index finger move inward. Then I picture my wife's head with a vermilion-colored streak running down her left temple. The makeup artist didn't do a good job, the one my sister hired. The hole gapes still visible near her left ear. Can I sue him for malpractice? Is that even a thing? My wife is dead, and a hefty settlement wouldn't bring her back. It happened too long ago anyway. The statute for that has probably run out. Time didn't register while in the asylum, but I know they locked me away for 5 years. She lay in the coffin, and I brushed my fingers over her cold, grayish hands. "Don't touch," she said. her eyes still shut closed. Her lips didn't move, but her voice cracked inside my ears as icicles. Murderer. I pick up the coffee can again. They handed her to me in a fancy urn, fit for royalty. But I transferred her ashes, because she loved coffee the most, more than she loved me. I open the canister. I can still detect the caramel scent as I examine the powdery substance and fragments of bones. I picture her grabbing her silk robe. She covered her naked body and stood in front of him. Get out, she shouted. Her voice reverberated in my tired ears, her glance a poisonous spear, piercing between my ribcage, aiming it for my heart. I stood frozen. This is my house, I said, staring at her in disbelief. I worked hard to provide, and he claimed to be my friend. Why did she? My muscles tightened, my nails digging deep into my palms. How could he? Rushing over to the nightstand, she grabbed the revolver I wasn't aware we owned. I saw the glimmer of the black metal in her hands. Bang! The sound erupted and deafening darkness set in. I stand and walk toward the waves to sprinkle her ashes on the glass sheet of the ocean, spread it out like a blanket. Yet the gentle breeze proves too frail to scatter her remains, a frigid reminder of betrayal and guilt. But she must go. The time is now for me to live again. She had appeared every night, haunting me while I was locked away. No doubt for a valid reason to torment and make me pay. But I figured she'd leave once I got out. Yet she's still here, at every motel room, in every state, pointing her finger at me, asking, why? I can't give her an answer. I don't know.